Welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in the studios of WMOT-FM. The MTSU English Department is celebrating the 20th anniversary of the biennial John Milton Conference, which it has conducted here in Murfreesboro since 1991, attracting scholars from all over the country and all around the world. And one of the co-organizers of it, Dr. Kevin J. Donovan, is our guest today. He's a professor of English and graduate program director for the Department of English. We'll be talking about Paradise Lost and why Milton continues to intrigue scholars and readers even to this day, right after these illuminating words from MTSUnews.com.
Here are a few of the stories now on MTSUnews.com, the university's news and information website. During the recent Economic Outlook Conference at MTSU, Dr. Donald Ratajczak, nationally known economist, said legislators must stop trying to bulldoze one another and instead be willing to come together to work out their differences. A pledge not to deliberate, he said, is a mistake. Madame Curie made an extremely rare appearance at MTSU to talk about her life and work. Local actress Lee Rennick reenacted the role of Curie on the 100th anniversary of the scientist receiving the Nobel Prize for Chemistry. The MTSU Child Care Lab recently celebrated its 30th anniversary of providing daycare for parents who are students and employees at MTSU. And finally, MTSU's fall 2011 enrollment, some 26,442 students, represented a modest increase over the previous year and set yet another enrollment record. For MTSU News Anytime, go to MTSUnews.com.
Dr. Kevin Donovan, welcome. Thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure, Gina.
Tell me a little bit about why this particular conference, now in its 20th year, has been able to continue to be as widely respected as it is among people who study the works of John Milton.
Well, in part, it's because when we began, there really wasn't another conference entirely devoted to the study of Milton. But the conference has also, I think, established a, well, not to brag, but a very strong reputation. We've had a number of leading world-renowned scholars as featured speakers and also delivering papers here over the years. Right from the start, the quality, the caliber of some of the scholars who have come here, I think, caught people's attention, and they've continued to come.
The essays that have been presented here by some of the scholars who have come to the conference have been bound, and one collection has won a prize from the Milton Society of America.
Yes, actually two. We now have two of the collections that my co-directors, Dr. Charles Durham and Dr. Kristen Pruitt, co-edited. Have won the Irene Samuel Prize from the Milton Society of America, which is a prize given to the best publication in a given year that involves works by more than one author. So yes, the caliber of the papers, and especially those that have been selected and invited to submit fuller versions for the published collections, but have been very high. One thing we do that's a little unusual is that we don't solicit abstracts, but only finished papers, which are more time-consuming to read. But let's face it, anybody can write an abstract and promise to have a finished paper, and you know, many times they'd be quite good. But it's a different thing altogether to submit a finished piece of work, and that's the way that we've operated right from the start.
An abstract, just to clarify, is just about a paragraph, sort of a long paragraph, that precedes the heart and the meat of a writing that would appear in an academic, scholarly, peer-reviewed journal. It's basically a synopsis. It tells you what the premise that the author is proposing or positing is, and then the author continues in the course of the paper to attempt to prove the point that he put out in the abstract. But you want to sit and read the entire paper to make sure that the person proposing to present it at your conference actually knows what he or she is talking about.
That's right. And that the argument can be sustained over the, 10 pages that the conference presentation would require. Usually the ones that are selected or invited to resubmit for the published collections send in an expanded, a longer version of the original 10-page paper.
I heard a character who portrayed a poet in a television program once say, one of his lines was, "If you want to understand the mysteries of the universe, Milton's your man." What do you think he meant by that?
Well, Milton is probably the most formidably learned of any poet who wrote in the English language. Not only did he have a university degree at a time when that was uncommon, but when he was done with that, he spent a period of years deliberately training himself for the task of writing an epic. He shared with other Renaissance thinkers and writers the idea that one who would write epic must know, well, almost everything. And so he, he read Hebrew scriptures in the original language and the New Testament in the original Greek and just about everything significant, it seems, written in Latin and English that was available to him.
This was not a man who would be satisfied with being a dilettante or a poseur. He would do the work.
Precisely. Poetry for him was a vocation, a sacred calling. He was very taken all his poetic career with the idea of the poet as a kind of prophet, especially one who would write poetry on sacred subjects, as he did in Paradise Lost. In Paradise Lost, he famously announces his project to justify the ways of God to man, and seems sincerely to believe that he was divinely inspired as well as formidably learned.
We'll get into a little bit of the works of John Milton, religious and otherwise, in just a moment. But first, we'll pause for this break on MTSU on the Record.
The Middle Tennessee Writing Project is a program that fosters the effective teaching of writing to students in kindergarten through high school. The Writing Project hosts annual summer institutes where teacher participants teach and learn from each other. In addition, the Writing Project sponsors summer writers' camps for youngsters. MTSU is one of 185 sites of the National Writing Project and one of only two in Tennessee. This is Dr. Bobby Solley, Project Director.
For more details, visit mtsunews.com.
And welcome back to MTSU on the Record. Our guest, Dr. Kevin J. Donovan, who is one of the three co-organizers of the biennial John Milton Conference here at MTSU that's taking place October 13th through the 15th. In reading about a little bit about Milton, it's rather obvious that he was going against the grain from the get-go, from the, virtually the very beginning of his life, even as a boy. Wouldn't you say that's true?
I would, and as unforeseen historical events developed during his career, his thinking and his writing also took directions that I think he would not could not have anticipated. Early on, he seems to have had in mind the idea of a vocation as a priest or minister in the Church of England, in the established church. But in the various polarization of religious and political ideologies leading to the Civil War in the 1640s, Milton increasingly found himself taking a position more radical than previously. Ultimately became a committed political writer who actually shelved. I mentioned all those years that he spent studying for that poetic career, training himself for that. But he put that largely on hold and deferred it to throw himself into the political cause of Republic against the king.
Go into a little detail about these historical events that characterized Milton's adult life. We're talking about the downfall of Charles I and the rise of Oliver Cromwell, right?
Yes. There had long been division an unsettled notion whether the extent of the relative powers of king and parliament. At the beginning of Milton's life, the monarch clearly held much more power than parliament. But over the course of the 1630s and then 40s, and of course, very complicated series of events, king and parliament fell out with each other, and ultimately, by the end of the 17th century, the long story is the parliament thenceforth really has more power than the king. But during Milton's time, what makes the struggle between king and parliament all the more bitter and all the more passionate is that most lethal of ingredients in politics, religion. The monarchy was aligned with the established church, and the bishops of the Church of England, especially the Archbishop of Canterbury in the 1630s, sort of unwisely managed to antagonize a good deal of the population of England as a whole. And as the distrust between the parliamentarians aligned with the Puritans, if these terms can be rather crude, but sometimes that those big divisions are necessary. Parliament and Puritans aligned against king and Anglicans.
And we're still dealing with a monarch who believes he rules by divine right, right?
Yes, that's right. The Stuarts, King James I and King Charles I, inherited and like to assert the notion of kingship as divinely ordained, which makes Milton's later position all the more strikingly radical when he denounces monarchy altogether and kingship as tyranny. As events during the Civil War take unexpected directions, he is increasingly aligned with a more politically radical positions, and ultimately defends the trial and execution of the king and denounces the whole institution of monarchy anywhere in the world.
According to what I'm reading, in the 1630s, he visited Rome and was a guest of the Pope's nephew. Stayed with him for a while and visited the Vatican Library. Is this a contradiction, or was this before he found his voice, for lack of a less trite way of saying it?
It's more of a paradox. It can seem somewhat contradictory. He seems to have been able to maintain friendships with Catholics, especially in Italy. He was very taken by Italian culture. I mean, he was still committed to a position where he, regarded the institution of the papacy with a lifelong degree of abhorrence and alarm over its possible gaining greater strength in England, but that did not prevent him from having sort of civilized friendships with Italian Catholics in particular.
When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about John Milton's take on divorce. And it was another example of his contrariness. This is MTSU on the Record.
Specialized training in forensic science prepares tomorrow's professionals through the Forensic Institute for Research and Education, or FIRE. The Forensic Anthropology Search and Recovery Team assists law enforcement with skeletal remains at crime scenes. Legendary forensic scientists provide lectures free to the public, and high school students work realistic crime scenes each summer at our CSI MTSU camp. I'm Dr. Hugh Berryman, Director of FIRE.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're back with Dr. Kevin J. Donovan talking about John Milton and the MTSU John Milton Conference. He did not have a happy first marriage. He had kind of a sad second marriage because his wife and daughter from that union passed away. But marriage pretty well convinced him that the option to divorce had to be a necessity for the human race, didn't it?
Yes. He during the early 1640s, when I suppose conveniently the ecclesiastical licensors were no longer able to control what could be printed due to the crisis between king and parliament. He published this series of divorce tracts, which were considered by, I'd say, the variety, majority of documented commentators to be scandalous. This was considered a kind of libertine position, and he was notorious for a time as Milton the Divorcer. This was before he had published any poetry, for all intents and purposes.
Mm-hmm. It is not surprising to learn that he also published an oration advocating freedom of the press. Basically, Milton was sowing the seeds, in a way, both with his bent toward egalitarianism and complete freedom of personal expression. He was sowing seeds that our founding fathers would take and implant in the new democracy in the United States of America, wasn't he, from a philosophical point of view?
Certainly in his role as a kind of self-conscious prophet of liberty, he would have been admired by some of the founding fathers. A number, in fact, of the political ideas that motivated the English Commonwealth survived and continued to be influential during the 18th century, and in particular on the founding fathers.
Milton was born long after Martin Luther passed away, but is there any evidence to indicate that Milton was influenced by Martin Luther? They strike me as being of similar iconoclastic stripe. in terms of their reluctance to let any one individual or any one ideology dominate their minds.
And yes, I think so. And in both cases, a notion of the New Testament ushering in a era of greater freedom. Milton and Luther, I think, would definitely have that in common.
He wrote a treatise called Of Education. What was Milton's perspective on education and what a good, well-rounded education should include?
Well, he set the bar high. In some ways, his treatise of education is, in its day, somewhat old-fashioned. He advocated a kind of strenuous grounding in classical culture and in the arts of rhetoric in particular. In fact, what we would call today the study of literature was within the curriculum of the Renaissance, positioned within the study of rhetoric. So perhaps it's not so surprising he put so much emphasis on that. I suppose what today would be called the language arts. Assumed, of course, that thorough grounding in Latin, which was and continued to be the language of international scholarship, was fundamental. In fact, he published quite a bit in Latin, especially some of the works that he wrote as a spokesman for the Commonwealth. During the 1650s, defending the policies and the legitimacy of the English Republic to the other states of Europe.
When we come back, we'll talk about what happens when a man of great insight loses his sight. This is MTSU on the Record.
Specialized training in forensic science prepares tomorrow's professionals through the Forensic Institute for Research and Education, or FIRE. The Forensic Anthropology Search and Recovery Team assists law enforcement with skeletal remains at crime scenes. Legendary forensic scientists provide lectures free to the public, and high school students work realistic crime scenes each summer at our CSI MTSU camp. I'm Dr. Hugh Berryman, Director of FIRE.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
Hi, I'm Jenna Logue. We're talking with Dr. Kevin J. Donovan of the English Department at MTSU and a co-organizer of the John Milton Conference, which happens once every 2 years here at MTSU, attracting scholars from all around the world. Milton lost his sight in 1652. How did he carry on when that happened?
Well, he had amanuenses, scribes who to whom he would dictate. For part of his life later on, in fact, his adult daughters served in that role, but he had other people who would help him as well. It's not surprising that when he composes Paradise Lost, ideas of light and vision versus darkness loom so large in his imagination, and the poem is shot through with very moving and eloquent poetic passages on the subject of light. What's curious is, though, that even when he was fully sighted, and as a young man, light and dark imagery somehow reverberated in his poetic imagination and is found among his earliest poems as well as his last.
Not being able to see external stimuli and being affected by what we see externally in the physical world, on the earthly plane. Could you make the argument that Milton might never have seen the visions and seen the imagination and experienced the kind of depth it took to write Paradise Lost had he not lost his sight?
Well, it's quite possible. Although some commentators have pointed out the ways in which he imagines a pretty consistent and fairly complicated model of the cosmos that later commentators have illustrated. That it's not it's surprisingly detailed in visual ways.
Is Paradise Lost a vision or a thought that Milton had in his head that he put off for a time, the way authors do, or was it something that he knew he absolutely had to get started on the minute he first thought of the idea?
Well, as I said before, he had been in training to be an epic poet, but his first plan, it seems, was to write a more conventional epic on the more conventional subject of military heroism and glorification of the nation. But he changed his mind, and perhaps in part as well due to his profound and bitter disappointment with politics and I suppose even with the English nation as a whole when they welcomed back Stuart monarchs with the restoration of King Charles II.
In fact, they threw him in jail, didn't they?
For a time, because he had been one of the regicides. Charles went after the regicides. Some of the ones who were already dead were dug out of their graves and their heads stuck on pikes by London Bridge. But I suppose this aged blind man, it would have been, among other things, pretty unseemly to subject him to public execution in that way.
How does John Milton best speak to 21st century readers?
Oh, that's a hard one. I think it's less a particular doctrine. There's much, probably the majority of what Milton actually has to say that I find myself not agreeing with. Attempt to, I suppose, apart from simply the courage and dedication to his art and to his beliefs, his advocacy for freedom and human dignity.
When you're blessed by God or whomever with genius, you would do yourself and your society a disservice by putting your critical thinking skills on hold. And if it's one thing Milton could never be accused of, it's putting his critical thinking skills on hold to satisfy other people.
That's very true.
Dr. Kevin J. Donovan, professor in the English department, the John Milton Conference, which is a biennial affair, this year will take place from October the 13th through the 15th here at MTSU. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Gina.
MTSU On the Record, a news and information program about Middle Tennessee State University, is produced by the university's Marketing and Communications Office, which is solely responsible for its content. Read more about MTSU at our website, mtsunews.com. Podcasts of this program are available at mtsunews.com and on iTunes.